The American writer John Cheevers, writing in the last number of years of the 20th century, writes about our seeming entrapment on the surface of a culture. Damn the bright lights by which no one reads. Damn the continuous music which no one hears. Damn the grand pianos which no one can play. Damn the white houses mortgaged to their rain gutters. Damn them for plundering the oceans for fish to feed the mink whose skins they wear. And damn the shelves on which there rests a single book, a copy of the telephone directory bound in brocade. So what is the nature of things? That's a basic question. If we know the nature of things, we stand on more solid ground. If we get it wrong, we waste time and we put things at risk and we use up precious resources that could be used elsewhere. If I do not understand the nature of a lion and I walk through its paddock, it will eat me. And if I do not understand the nature of gasoline and see it as a sweet-smelling liquid and drink it, it will poison me. And if I do not know the nature of a radio and actually turn it on or plug it in, I will never hear the news of the world or the music of the spheres. To know the nature of things is essential. So what is the nature of things? Or at least a few vital things. On this Thanksgiving Sunday, let us stay in the natural realm for our thinking, in the biological and psychological state in which we live. Our relationships are with people and with a culture, and that culture is changing. Now, I'm not a huge Stephen Harper fan, never have been, but I was reading an excerpt yesterday from his newest book. And he acknowledges that everything is swinging to the right all over the world. We swing on a pendulum toward globalization and the benefit of all of us as one people. But now the pendulum is swinging the other way. And those of us who seem to have resources and have strength are now sitting in front of rusted out factories and lives that are seemingly being diminished, while others on other side of the world are gaining in great leaps and bounds, and we on this side of the world have had enough of it, and so we are resorting to palisades and barricades and tribes and genders and us as opposed to them, and it's going to get worse. We're swinging on a pendulum towards the right, he writes. We also have a relationship to a sensed central power. Call it anything you like, call it by a variety of names, an ethereal power, call it creator, call it inspiration, call it strength, wind beneath our wings, call it anything you like, but it brings life to us and it moves in all things. There are times for movements to be born, we realize, and there are times in which movements die and other movements are born. And they're all held together by some power which we sense but can never quite grasp the nature of it. Everything in our whole life is about that power, that central power, and our relationship to it. And so Thanksgiving, although it's seen in vegetables and in feasts and family, is really ultimately thankfulness to that power which we can not fully name, but which holds us all in warm hands. Now, the word food comes into play today. The harvest season, the bounty of our country, the often unheralded labor of farmers and all of those across the land who support them. I think about food. I'm not much of a vegetable eater, but I'll have to eat vegetables today. People will be watching me. But I do remember years and years ago on a summer mission field standing in a farmyard in northern New Brunswick, and one of my old mentors saying to me, "Look at this turnip." And I thought, "Ooh, turnip." He said, "You see how beautifully it's waxed?" I said, "Yes." He said, "I waxed that myself with 3 or 4 coats of wax, and my wife Ethel is going to cook that for you today, and I want you to eat it for dinner." And I smiled sweetly like an upper Canadian, a fine and obedient student minister, and at dinner we had turnip. And it was the sweetest turnip I'd ever eaten in my life. Surprise, surprise. And we have our own festive tables before us today, those with us in life or in memory who we adore. I can still see when I close my eyes my father standing in my grandmother's kitchen year after year and carving a turkey beautifully, just carving it like a surgeon. I carve the turkey at home and I start with a knife, and after a couple of cuts I realize it isn't going to work. And then I pull it apart with my fingers, and most of the people at the table end up having ham. I've never understood that. But I want to suggest to you today that we see the word food as a verb. God foods us. Life foods us. We food others in our kindness and in our watchfulness of society. We are fooding each other all the time. And I want to see the word blessing as a directive, not just a noun or a state of mind or a desired outcome. What we are to do is to be a blessing for each other. We are to care and consider and cooperate and campaign and combine and combust into flame that spirit that is within us. Blessing. Blessing is an outcome. And then there's the word mortality, and we know all about mortality too, don't we? When the grain is harvested and the crop is gathered in, the soil seems exhausted as if it's dead, and a dark, cold season follows its dying. But life may well be hiding there, we hope it is, but the future bringing that life to its fullness is always unclear. So let mortality be something of a focus on this Thanksgiving weekend. We are here only a while. Our health and our vigor are only with us a while. We shall all know a measure of vulnerability and inability and the need to trust others and the need to redefine ourselves before it's over. William Shakespeare wrote, "All the world is a stage and all men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts." The way we use words at Thanksgiving focuses who we are and what we do. So the nature of things. What is the nature of nature? Well, I suggest to you that nature is intended to support us and to save us. Is that so unusual? Is that hard to believe? I'll bet it is when we read the newspaper headlines and look at the world around us and we hear news of global warming, that even if we start to address it now, we will not turn it around in any reasonable way for over 500 years. Bad news. And the ruination of rivers and the trash in the oceans and the toxic chemicals in the lakes and the great piles of trash that see small children picking for what they can find in the refuse in other countries, and the teeming millions floundering, social intolerance about them and about each other growing, visions for the future and for peace in the present seemingly elusive. It can be a bleak world with nature only as a backdrop and a half-hearted participant in all this. But when I read the passage from the book of Joel, the poet Joel, I saw in his writing a poetic metaphor. We are all the creatures mentioned in his poetry. The overarching directive in the poem of Joel is do not fear. Do we not need to hear that today? Do not fear. Fear is vulnerability and danger and weakness and inevitability and mortal threat and alienation and deceit and social scandal. There seems so much to fear. Do not fear. We are soil, he says. Within our ordinariness, great things grow. Great lives, great loves. Great discoveries, artistry, music, adventure, legends, myths, dreams that take us beyond the stars. The soil, the simple soil that we all are, is filled with wonders, says the poet. Do not fear, you animals, he says. We are animals. We are dependent on the earth. If a tsunami comes, we drown. If an earthquake comes, we are crushed to death under the falling stones. Drought and fires and wars and plagues can decimate our ranks and have done so across time since the beginning. The great fear which unites one world is some pandemic that's going to come somewhere and sweep across our medical science and kill 3/4 of us before it's done. Yet as long as we live, we all pass through a common series and cycle of lives. Infancy, childhood, adolescence, young adulthood, middle age, maturity of years, old age, infirmity, and death. And it all seems profoundly natural, and it's full of gifts. I was called this week to conduct a funeral of people I did not know. The daughter of the mother who had died wrote me in great detail about her mother. Obviously, it was a very loving family. She said, "Would you read this tribute?" And I said I would. And she sent it to me, and I read of this delightful Irish woman who had lived into her 80s and had made such a difference to her family and to the world. And then I went there, and I met her husband, who was grieving, a lovely Irish man with a twinkle in his eye, and I met his family and his grandchildren, and I read the piece, and I put the small party pieces around the funeral oration that I would normally bring, and when I was bringing it all to a close, the family stood up and said, "We haven't done our part yet." And then they all stood up, and the daughter paid tribute to her mother. And then all the grandchildren stood up and each in turn spoke about simple kindnesses and broad understandings and an abiding love and things they would never, ever, ever forget. And the room was filled with love. I said to them at the end, "I have an Irish story for you." Alec Madol was the uncle of my dearest friend, and as a boy, he went down to the Belfast lock one morning and got into a small boat by the dock. He undid the rope and sat there a while, just thinking his childhood thoughts. A fog came down, and the tide went out, and took him out into the sea, far out into the sea, in a mist through which he could not find his way. He sat there terrified, seemingly all night, and in the morning the tide had shifted, and when the fog lifted, he was sitting in the boat beside the dock that was his home. "That is how it is ultimately in the world," I said to them. "We who have been lost drift out to sea a while in the fog, but by some grace greater than ourselves, in the heart of the love you have known, we end up in front of our own dock, our own field, and our own house." Well, I was very, very touched by meeting them. Sometimes the gifts we go to take with us do not even measure up to the gifts we're given when we get there. In each cycle we go through, the world offers us people and insights and experiences and rich learnings that seem more than just a passing thing. We discover leaders we can believe in, and we discover eternal friendships, and we realize that that love lasts beyond the grave, and thoughts and feelings that make us more than we are ours. There is a wonder alive in our mortal human nature. "Do not fear," says the poet. The poet also calls his audience the children of Zion and indicates that we all belong to something, a tribe, an era, a culture, a world of shared experiences, a timeline. And when we touch the center together, we know it. Were you fortunate enough to be here last Sunday evening for our anniversary musical service? We invited 5 congregations who are associated with us in City Ministry. There were 100 members in the choir, and they sang "I Was Glad" by C.H. Perry. You can hear it in The Royal Wedding. And when they sang that song, standing on the steps, the sound went out like a great tsunami through the church. My knees buckled and my eyes filled with tears. Here was the central beauty to which we all belong, be we Catholic or Protestant or Anglican or visitor from somewhere else. We all belong to it. And Peter Holmes, the minister of Yorkminster Park Church, preached on the text, "How lovely are thy dwellings." And the service was lovely, and the sermon was lovely. And people said afterwards, it was so soft, just just like all of us together being in a warm bath. No attitude, no edge, no fear. Just all of us together in a warm bath. When you get to the center of things, you know you're there. God gave the early rain, says the poet, needed to spur our growth and germination. And God gives us the late rain to finish the ripening. We see it. You put a little pumpkin seed in the ground sometime early in the spring, and when you look out today, you see a pumpkin patch filled with gourds of all different sizes, some of them as big as a compact car, and they're all ready and shining by All Saints' Day. Is that not a miracle? Is that not a metaphor for something deep? Now, the poet goes on to say that we are a compensated people, too, and that's difficult, perhaps, for us to believe, a compensated people. And what he means is that sadness and joy in life will eventually balance out. Do we believe that? That sadness and joy will eventually balance out. That grief and a deepening reunion in things will both be ours along the way. We will know a time between skins, and it will seem frightening indeed, and we will be vulnerable then. But then we will grow together and find ourselves putting on the whole armor of God. Over 40 years ago, my first marriage ended, and my first wife said she had had enough of me, and I remember the sadness of losing my children, and I remembered the emptiness inside and the ache so deep that I would go and sit on a bench in a local plaza and feel somewhat comforted just by hearing the voices of people as they were walking by. And now, 40 years later, down the road, a lifetime of children and experiences and a wife who loves me, and this experience to be with you and the gifts of ministry over years and years and years, and I come to realize how fortunate I am that a seed that began to grow sour and wild in a field long ago has turned into something so rich and so blessed. We are a feasting people. There are good times for us when goodness lingers. Great people have had their way with us, and God is at our shoulder every single day. Do not fear. Lead me, Lord, lead me in thy righteousness. Make thy way plain before my face. For it is thou, Lord only, who makes me dwell in safety. So wrote Dr. Samuel Sebastian Wesley, the grandson of the great Wesley legacy. So if the nature of nature is to support and save us, what then is the nature of human nature? In the letter to Timothy, the literary device used is that of a mentor writing to his protege. That's the device in the letter. The mentor is some Christian apologist whose name we do not know, and the protege is a series of small churches gathering in houses in Asia Minor. Human nature is to watch for greatness, says the writer, and to nurture greatness when you see it. We have our show coming up, Metropolitan, the musical, over 200 years, on the 3rd of November. I hope you'll be here to see it. It's quite wonderful, people stepping out of the pews and presenting 200 years of our history. And towards the end of it, without giving the whole thing away, we change guides. And two of our younger children, the youngest ones in the congregation, step forward to take us through our earliest and most formative years. And one of the little ones steps out and says to the crowd, "This is the best part!" And with that, he goes on to tell us why it is. And it is. We are to dig for the good things in life and to fight the good fight for them. We are to battle the bad things in life. Someone said to me this morning, "Perhaps I shouldn't be bringing my social political anger into worship today. Perhaps I should calm down in the face of God." And I suggested that she ramp up. Ramp up. Go ahead. Discern. Rage. Express righteous indignation. You have been given a sense of moral wisdom. Use it. We all need people who discern, people in leadership. As we sing in the church, people are suffering in the alcoves, and we are called to do something about it. As I was coming into the play rehearsal a week or so ago, stepping from my car to the front door, I saw a woman lying curled up in the alcoves, just a figure of herself. It could have been a pile of rags, and I couldn't get her out of my mind. I wrote this about her. She lay curled up in the fresh asphalt by the church wall, prone there in her yellow coat all day, turned this way and that in her hours of stupor sleep. Said she was all right when we shook her shoulder once to check, a youngish woman, thin and lost. A few gathered remnants of food and drink beneath her, like chicks beneath their hen, and a National Geographic magazine lying loosely nearby. See the world from the ground up. Dream your dreams through a drug dealer who doesn't see you at all. Human nature must take stock of political power and how we use social power with each other. We must live together creatively somehow. The authority under 1 Timothy is no revolutionary or no rebel. He is not a rabble-rouser trying to lift us up to do things. Indeed, he comes from a steady connection with something very gentle, and perhaps it doesn't fit always in our contemporary moment. He advocates that we pray for the powers. Is this the right time to pray for the powers, do you think? To mock people, to mock the powers, to ridicule the powers, to tweak their noses, actively to undermine them at every turn, creates huge waves of disruption for everybody. Mocking leaders breeds hatred in the leaders and puts everybody at risk. Now, I'm not suggesting we don't fight for the basic truths. These are essential in this awful business with Trump and Kavanaugh and Blasey Ford and all the things out of which we've ripped out our hearts this week. It is absolutely essential to try to see through to a right and honorable thing and to stand for that honorable thing. And it's true about Me Too and Black Lives Matter, and to give sex education to our children about things that are true about our own bodies and relationships, and in the international courts of justice that have the power to override tyranny. All of those things are essential in common life. But beyond the battles, there comes a sense of order. There must come a sense of order sometime. Perhaps the source of our prayers leads us in that direction, else we will be at each other's throat in time and eternity. And in our midst, there is the supreme power, the figure of leadership style. There is the Christ in our midst. The Christ is always more than Jesus. The Christ is always more than one person. It is he or she who proves to be the bridge between the sweetness of eternal things and the terror of temporal things. That is the Christ. And as followers of Christ, we have been placed on that bridge. And it's frightening up there. It's high. It's swerving up there. The winds are howling up there on the bridge. It's easy to look down and to lose our balance and to begin to tumble towards the rocks and rivers that are lying there below. But it is in our nature to be bridge builders as followers of Christ. The ultimate key to things is reconciliation and deep and abiding belonging. The bridge will connect. The bridge will hold. First Nations and racial harmony and gender appreciation, the place of wealth and power in the world, the crippling effects of poverty and alienation, all these things, the tyranny of violence, the rejection of strangers, the intentional breaking of hearts are all down there, lying among the rocks and the flowing rivers, and we are on the bridge, and we see them, and we are called to address them in the spirit of the Christ. Perhaps the Matthew passage speaks about the nature of our response. What's going to happen if I respond? What's going to happen to me if I take the step and show my face? That's always the question. Well, it's important to do it. We are not joyriders in this world. We do not always get the best seats in time and the quick escorted journey to the front of the line. We are not that privileged, none of us. We are worthy and we are able, and so is every other creature we meet. And it's important to hold the door open to see that worth and that ability. So what happens to us when we step up to do more? Well, we move a cog and lever in our own life, and other cogs and wheels that we never saw begin to move as well, and we may be at risk. But Matthew echoes the poet in Joel, "Do not worry about tomorrow," he writes. Life is more than food and drink and clothing and personal safety. There is one with us who knows our need, who clothes all things, and there is a wave of strength around us on which we ride every day. Does anyone still believe that on Thanksgiving Day? When I go out every morning, I'm conscious of my relationships in life. I'm conscious of my relationship to myself. I look in the mirror, I think, my God, where did that old man come from? And I think about my health and my conduct and my motivation and my style of dress and my calorie count. Every day you think about that. And then I think about my relationships to my spouse and my children and my wider family, my neighbors, my congregation. I think about my relationship to my saints who are living and dead. And I'm accountable for my laziness and my selfishness and my fears and my temptations and my failings. I'm accountable for all of that every day. And I go out heavily into the world, laden down every day. Don't you? And I hear the voice of God crying, "Don't worry. There is a bridge there. There is a companion there. There is a way through these woods for you to know and for you to walk. Seek first the deepest things you know." Well, the nature of ministry is to offer a fearless welcome to everyone we meet. The world around us contains seeds and rain and wind and animal agency and seasons and cycles and sunlight, and all these come together and they serve us and they feed us unbidden. That is the nature of the world, and in a gracious way we step out to follow suit. Do not be afraid. Do not fear fighting for true things. Do not cease from carrying the whole range of people in your daily prayers. Do not worry about tomorrow, because tomorrow is a day filled with the horses and the chariots and the food and the drink and the guidance and the glory of God. Thanks be to God who gives us the victory through Jesus the Christ. Amen.